spontaneously found because of the fact that three different working men's revolutionary organizations, one in Germany, one in England, one in France, were meeting, and in the midst of their meetings, they decided to call on Marx to help them write up a program and to issue an international call for the collaboration of working people throughout Europe for the coming revolution that they envisioned breaking out on the horizon. And that was found during the midst of the American Civil War and lasted through the Paris Commune of 1871 and was finally buried in 1876 in Philadelphia here in order to stop the anarchists from taking over. Now, the Second International was founded in 1889 on the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the French Revolution. And we went into a little description of the background of the German socialist movement because that was the main driving force in organizing the Second International. And we pointed out how even by 1889, Marx and Engels were very suspicious of any future for the German social democracy, that is, as a revolutionary organization. That they already smelt a scent of reformism creeping into the social democracy led by Kautsky, those names there, Kautsky, Babel, and Bernstein. Kautsky and Bernstein were intellectuals, and Babel was a working man who established himself as an authority in the trade union movement. And they were the three leaders of the German social democracy as founded in 1889. I pointed out how in the 1880s, when Bismarck, who was the Chancellor of Germany, had anti-socialist laws passed, the paper had to be printed outside of Germany and then smuggled in, and that Bernstein and Kautsky were the editors of the paper, and that they started to adapt themselves to the anti-socialist restrictions passed by the government. And that this led to a dispute between Marx and Engels on one side and Kautsky and Bernstein on the other, to the extent that Marx and Engels were ready to break up all political relationship with them. In other words, declare war, because we don't break off relationships without declaring war and start to build a new organization. Now, this German social democracy built itself to be a powerful organization in Germany. To the extent of having 110 members in the Reichstag, that was the German parliament. They had I don't know exactly the number of daily newspapers, not weekly papers like the Militant or a small paper like the Militant, but big powerful newspapers, something in the hundreds. All cities in Germany had a daily socialist paper controlled by the social democracy. Not so much by the party, but by individuals in the party. The same as in this country here, in the socialist party, some multimillionaire decides that he's a socialist and he starts putting out a newspaper on his own hook with no control of it by the leadership of the party. So that the first thing you know, there's 47 varieties of Heinz soup and there's 47 varieties of socialism peddled by the ultra-leftist sectarian to the promising Wall Street banker, you might say, if the paper is so pale as far as socialism is concerned. Well, the same thing happened in Germany. Then, of course, the German social democracy built the trade union movement, and that gave them another nest egg for jobs. A million and one organizers of the unions and so forth, and all the different jobs functionary jobs that go with any kind of a bureaucracy that's necessary to a bureaucracy. Then, of course, they had the members in the Reichstag. Besides controlling all kinds of credit unions that working people patronized. So all in all, the German social democracy was not only a big political organization, but it was a big employment organization, too. No doubt, hundreds of thousands of German working people and petty bourgeois elements depended for their bread and butter on their jobs in the social democracy. That's the kind of an organization it grew into. Now, a very light-minded attitude was taken towards theory. The Second International was built on a centralized basis. It was a super democracy to let every party do as a damn well pleased. So one party said, we don't believe in strikes, and the other party says, oh yeah, we believe in strikes, and the other party said we should have a general strike if war is declared, and the other one said, well, I don't know about that, but I'll vote for it, doesn't mean anything, I'll vote for it. And that's what they did. At these conventions of the Second International, as I say, each party was completely independent of the other. They would, Lenin and Luxembourg attempted to form a left wing, and they introduced a resolution at the convention of 1912, I believe it was, or 1908, that in case of the threat of war in Europe, all the social democracies would stick together and call a general strike, and that would paralyze the various imperialist governments. Well, they all voted for it, these big pot-bellied trade union officials and so forth, they all voted for it with both hands. It didn't mean any more than them voting hooray for the Kaiser. It didn't make any difference whether the motion said down for the Kaiser, hooray for the Kaiser, and they just raised their hands. And that's all it meant. It was just a piece of paper. Well, so much for that till we come to it again. Now, today we're going to give a picture of the background of the Third International. And the Third International, as we know, ushered out of the Russian social democracy and out of the Russian Revolution, the victorious seizure of power by the Russian workers and peasants led by the Bolsheviks. Now, just as we had to know something about the background of the German social democracy to get a picture of the corruption of the Second International, so we have to get an idea of the background of the Russian social democracy to get an idea of what kind of a party was this, that out of all the parties of the Second International, this country, which had a small social democracy, that was always fighting among itself, that had no unity among itself, how come that this party, or a part of this party, led the only socialist seizure of power out of the Second World War, of which there were a half a dozen revolutions, and none of them were successful outside of the Russian Revolution. And out of this came the Third International. So we have to know something about the background of the Russian social democracy. Now, as you know, Russia started to industrialize late. It came upon the scene late. And the founder of Russian Marxism was a man named Plekhanov. That's the first name up there. He was the founder of Russian Marxism. He was a brilliant writer, a brilliant intellectual, and a brilliant theoretician. And he was Lenin's teacher. Plekhanov was Lenin's teacher. And Lenin one time made a remark after the seizure of power and so forth, and after Plekhanov had become a social patriot, that you can't understand Marxian philosophy unless you study Plekhanov. In other words, he respected the man's ability as a great theoretician. Now, Plekhanov not only founded Russian Marxism, but he attempted to build a party. And around the latter part of the 1890s, or the early part of the 1890s, rather, he founded a grouping called the Emancipation of Labor Groups, which was intended to start local groups all through the main cities of Tsarist Russia. And it was into one of these groups that Lenin joined in Petersburg. That is now Leningrad. And towards the end of the 1900s, they called for a national convention to found the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. The party was founded, I think, in 1898, but it never existed because it was a small attended convention in the first place. And secondly, when all the delegates returned to Tsarist Russia, every single one of them was picked up by the police and shipped off to Siberia. Now, this is living proof that the Russian police, the Tsarist police, penetrated into the revolutionary organizations and knew everything that was going on, who the individuals were, and so forth and so on. And there was chicken feed for them to pick them up and ship them off to Siberia, so that the party never got off the ground. In the meantime, Lenin came back from Siberia and launched his fight to start building a real revolutionary party in Russia. And he wrote several works. The main one, the two main ones are Where to Begin, and the second one is What is to Be Done. And out of these two books comes the basic concept of how to build a revolutionary party. And every comrade if she or he wants to know the basic fundamentals on how to build a revolutionary party, a Marxist party, they must study these two books. You don't read these books, you study them. And we should have study classes on these two books, where you would have discussion section by section, not the whole book, and then have a report on it, not at all. Now, Lenin's concept followed in the footsteps of the writings of other famous Russian revolutionaries, mainly an organization, mainly from a man named Chernyshevsky, who was not only a great revolutionary, but also a great Russian novelist. And he wrote a book, What Is to Be Done, where he expounded the concept of centralism, the same as all revolutionary parties in Russia had to be built on. And Lenin picked up that concept, but he adjusted it to the realities of Tsarist Russia. That is that in order to build a party in Russia, you have to have a very highly centralized organization. Why? To protect the members from the Tsarist police. If you had a nice, full-blown, democratically run organization, nevertheless centralized, like our own party, there could be a million and one police agents and agents provocateurs in the party. And no sooner do you have a convention than the police department has the name of every delegate. So there wouldn't be any sense in building a party like that. You wouldn't build it, that's all there is to it, because they'd all be picked up. No, Lenin said, if we're going to build an organization, we have to build it from the top down, not from the bottom up, not have a convention and elect from the bottom up a central committee, not at all. You have a convention, true enough, but you elect the leaders, a bureau. And this bureau appoints the national committee of the party, appoints the functionaries of the party, so that I don't know who is the functionaries. None of my goddamn business. I'm not on the bureau of the party. I'm not among the four or five that have been elected to the bureau. Nobody knows who the party functionaries are. Nobody knows who's in the party, even. And these functionaries, they used to call it the Central Committee abroad and the Central Committee in Russia, the field workers, what we call in this country party organizers. These men had unlimited authority in building the party in Russia. They could come into Moscow, we'll say, and there's just been some arrests in the party in Moscow. They could come into Moscow and dissolve the whole party, period, that's all. There's no arguments. There's no saying whoever told you could dissolve the party. The party was just dissolved, period. Not only that, but they'd appoint a new executive committee. And they'd decide whether it was going to be 40 members or 2 members. And they would decide who's going to be a member of the party in Moscow. They had to do this in order to protect the party from provocateurs. If you read Trotsky's biography of Stalin, he'll tell you that in 1912, this is unbelievable, almost, in 1912, that is 5 years before the seizure of power by the Bolsheviks, there was not a social democratic organization in the city of Moscow, the second largest city in Russia. There was no organization of a socialist nature in the city of Moscow. Why? Because it had been cleaned out by the police. The whole organization had been picked up and dispersed all over Siberia, which shows how that Lenin was correct, that they had to have a very highly centralized organization. Either that or there was no revolution. There's no use talking about revolution if you're not going to build an organization to carry through the program of the party. Now, the party was really founded in 1902. After the failure of the first convention where everybody was picked up, they had a second convention in 1902. And by this time, Lenin was already accepted by the Russian workers and the members of the party in Russia as possibly the equal to Plekhanov. Plekhanov had tremendous prestige. But by this time, Lenin himself also had terrific prestige among the Russian workers because of his writings and because of the fact that he had done work inside Tsarist Russia. And he had served a couple of terms in Siberia. And he attended the convention in 1902 and had a hand in writing the program of the party and the constitution of the party. And a split took place at this convention over a very minor issue, very minor, as we say. One of the great things about Marxism is that we pride ourselves on being dialecticians. What does it mean, this word dialectician and so forth? Dialectical thinking. It means we accept the concept of evolution. That everything is and everything isn't. Everything is in motion. Nothing stands still. No matter what it is, it is today and it isn't tomorrow. None of us are the same as we were when we came in this room, because some of our hair has fallen off, some of our skin has changed, and so forth. Everything is continually changing. The expression, from little acorns come the big oak trees or something. Well, it's the same thing with a little minor developments politically. If they're traced out to their logical conclusion, it can mean quite a different thing from this little couple of words in the resolution. And that's what happened in 1902. The program of the party, or the constitution of the party, on the section of who could be a member of this party, there was a section that said anybody that works for the social democracy will be a member of the party. Well, that sounds all right. But this Lenin, the sectarian, and the troublemaker, the guy who was always arguing over words and so forth that nobody could please, said, now, wait a second, that's wrong. In my opinion, no one can be a member of the party unless he or she accepts the discipline of the party. Hey, that's different. Hey, that's different. The right-wingers, the elements led by a man named Martov, M-A-R-T-O-V, said anybody that gives money to the party, they should be have the right to be a member of the party. Anybody that distributes leaflets for the party, they have a right to be a member of the party. And I said, oh, no. He can give $1 million to the party if he wants to, but he's going to give it to under our direction. He'll give it under the discipline of the party. And the party will say where this money is going, not him. Anybody that joins this party gives everything. You're not a millionaire and you put your money in your pocket and say, well, I'll throw out a half a buck a day. You will like, oh, brother, you give your $1 million to the party. And the party will say where it's going to go. You don't like those conditions? Well, don't be a member. No one's forcing you to. That's how the Bolsheviks organized. When you join the movement, everything belongs to the party. As Trotsky said on the 10th anniversary of the founding of the Trotskyist movement in this country, Trotsky gives he gave a talk, and he said that, how the party teaches us everything. The party teaches us to be conscious of life. And that's what it is, right? Who else in the United States is conscious of life? Outside of the Trotskyists. You tell me who. The Stalinists that are saying, well, I think we should vote for Johnson. We've got to whisper it under our breath because they get wise that we're fakers. But we should vote against whoever's running, meaning vote for Johnson. There's no other alternative. Well, they're a pack of outrageous fakers. And nobody can teach the working class the truth, only the Trotskyists. We're ready to debate that issue any day of the week and twice on Sunday. In other words, our party program and our traditions have taught us Marxism, and Marxism has taught us the realities of life and has made us conscious of what's going on the world on a day-to-day basis. None of us are going to drop dead because the British pound has been devaluated. We understand why. We saw it coming. And neither God, man, nor the devil could stop it. And we understand why it was devaluated. And we can also know that this is going to have international repercussions. We also know that the American capitalists can live for quite a while on Keynesian economics of big borrowing and stealing money to throw into the military machine to keep production going, keep priming the pump. But we also know there has to be a day when the time comes, what do you say? When are you going to start paying off these bonds, brother? At the same time, you have inflation continually going on, and there has to be an end to that, too, because Britain went through that, and France is going through it, too. And they'll come to the same situation as England did, unless they come over here and borrow some more dough like they've had in the past. So, in other words, Marxism teaches us to be conscious of life. And Trotsky pointed that out, that's the great contribution that the party makes. And in return, what does the party demand? He made the statement the same as Lenin did. The party demands everything. That's what the party demands. Not that someone play with politics, not that someone come into the party and play with it, not someone come into the party and take the party program as some kind of a book to have mental exercises with, not an organization where if you have some crackpot idea come popping into your head that you demand the right to have this propagandized in the ranks of the party and so forth. None at all. The party demands everything in return for teaching us the realities of life and making revolutionaries all of us. Now that was Lenin's concept of how to build a party. You join this party, you give everything or you stay outside. You can be a sympathizer and you can throw a few bucks to us when we need it. Or you can distribute a leaflet someday if you want to. And this caused a split in the organization. And at that convention, on that particular question, Lenin had a majority. And that was how the word Bolshevik became attached to Lenin and Leninism and the organization that he ultimately founded. And the word Menshevism in Russian means minority. That's the meaning of Bolshevik and minority. Today we know that Bolshevism means quite different. But they split in 1902. And from 1902, to make a long story short, from 1902 up to the seizure of power, 1917, there was continual fighting between these two groupings. And in periods of reaction, the right wingers, those who had the concept of building an organization on a loose basis, of having low qualifications for membership, in the period of reaction, they always showed their true colors, as all right wingers do. The deeper the reaction, the more of the party program they were willing to throw overboard in order to stay in the swim, in order to stay with the masses, in order to be accepted legally where the party was illegal, in order to conform to the law so we can carry on our propaganda. Well, you can't carry on effective propaganda if you're going to say to the workers, don't overthrow Tsarism. That was the whole basis of the Russian social democracy, of teaching the workers that there was no other way out but a revolutionary solution to the problem of Tsarism. Now, they had the revolution in 1905, and under the pressure of the events of the Russian Revolution of 1905, these two groupings started to drift together. Up to this time, the ranks of the Bolshevik grouping were not clarified as to their relationship to other organizations. And they took the teachings of Lenin up to that time, where Lenin said that the party must always have an unsullied banner and not lose the banner among all kinds of reformist organizations. They took that to mean that the party stood aside from all other organizations. And they had nothing to do, in 1905, the Bolsheviks had nothing to do with the Soviets, which was a spontaneous organization set up by the working class in Petersburg. The result is the Bolsheviks were isolated and played no role to amount to a row of pins in the 1905 revolution. By the time Lenin came back, everything was cut and dried, the revolution was on the wane, so that the Bolsheviks played no role. But in this situation, Trotsky came to the surface as the leader of the Russian Revolution. At the age of 26 years, Trotsky was recognized as the leader of the first Russian Revolution in 1905. Now, who was Trotsky? Trotsky was 10 years younger than Lenin. Lenin was born in 1870, which made him 35 years of age in 1905. And Trotsky was born in 1880, which made him 25 years of age, 26 years of age when he was president. And like Lenin, he also had a brilliant mind. And he served his time in Siberia and was a delegate to the convention of 1902. At the convention in 1902, he opposed Lenin's concept of centralization. He took it to mean that the party would be so organized that it would lead to a dictatorship of the bureau. And this meant that one man would be the dictator of the bureau and therefore the dictator of the party. And he didn't go for that. And he sided in with the Mensheviks. He stayed with the Mensheviks for a short period of time, a few months, that's all, and then went into business for himself. Set up a grouping of his own, which developed the theory of permanent revolution. Now, among the Russian revolutionaries, unlike the revolutionaries of other countries, there was a very high sprinkling of intellectuals. And in Russia, anybody that was a professional person was called an intellectual. It didn't mean a professor. Like in this country, when we think of intellectuals, we think of professors, writers, and so forth. But in Russia, it was quite different. Anybody that was a professional person was an intellectual. But the Russian party had real intellectuals. Men and women are very highly educated. Many of them had served time in Siberia and in the prisons of Russia, which were called the universities for revolutionaries, because in prisons they could exchange ideas and conduct all kinds of lectures and studies of revolutionary ideology and so forth and so on, which was of course abolished by Stalinism when Stalinism took over the Soviet government. But in the days of Tsarism, the prisons were known as the University for the Revolutionaries. Well, Trotsky developed this concept of permanent revolution. And this was one of the concepts that separated Lenin from Trotsky up to 1970, as well as the organizational side of the question. Trotsky said this in so many words: Russia is a country that has come upon the scene, in as far as the capitalist world is concerned, later than the major industrial countries. And this has resulted in the development of capitalism on a different basis than in other countries. That is, it didn't go through with the stages of primitive accumulation that the other countries did over a period of centuries in gathering enough capital to start the development of capitalism, the building of immense factories and so on. In Tsarist Russia, they imported the capital, mainly from France and Belgium, as well as other countries, but those were the two main countries. And these capitalists in France and in Belgium took their surplus profits and invested them in Tsarist Russia to build big, immense factories, naturally the latest factories and the latest developments from their own country, as well as buying into the banking system and starting banks in Tsarist Russia. Now, the banking system held all kinds of mortgages on the land. If you read anything about the Russian nobility of pre-war vintage of 1917, you'll see that, like all nobility that was living off the fat of the land, money meant nothing to them. They spent it like water. While the peasants had famines, they were in Paris raising hell. And the result was that the land was mortgaged to the hilt. And Trotsky said this: in Russia, if you have a revolution, it means you have to take the land away from the nobility and distribute it to the peasants. That means that you're stealing the land from the banks, because the nobleman really doesn't own the land. The mortgages are all held by the banks. If you do that, the banks collapse. So what you can't have a capitalist revolution in Russia. You follow me? You can't have a capitalist revolution in Russia, because if you do, you have to give the land to the peasants. And that means that the bank, the mortgages are wiped out and the banking system would collapse. So there can't be any revolution in Russia unless you have a socialist revolution. You take the damn banks with the land. You take the whole works. Now this, we're not talking in 1967. This madman is talking in 1905, before there's any socialism in any country. And when he came up with this concept, Lenin said, petty bourgeois radicalism, that's all. Lenin Trotsky is a petty bourgeois politician, daydreamer. Rosa Luxemburg accepted that theory. The great Rosa Luxemburg, as I explained last week, for the benefit of any comrades that weren't here last week, Rosa Luxemburg was a woman who was a paralytic. I mention that only to give you an idea of her greatness. At the age of 26, he was the undisputed leader of the Polish Socialist Movement, the revolutionary Polish Socialist Movement. Now, this was a remarkable accomplishment, considering the fact that she was a woman. When we think of the rights that women had in the year 1900, 1895. Not only that, but being a paralytic on top of it.